Playing here, shopping here, it will be a vibrant community once again.
Yeah, I think the avenue looking all, you know, kind of just hustle and bustle again and a little bit more, you know, poppin'.
Poppin' is the word. And it will be a section of Indianapolis that people take a great deal of pride upon because we've maintained the history of what was here, who was here, and how it was. It's reconciliation and moving forward and a healing.
Claudia is clearly walking in her mother's footsteps. So are Paula Brooks and Kayla Austin. They're all fighting to reclaim and protect the history that once was, and to set a path for a brighter future.
That was part two of a two-part series on Indianapolis and its Black history. It's from our friends at Urbanist Media. And that does it for today's show. I'm Salima Hamarani, and thanks for listening to Making Contact.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland, 90.7 on your FM dial.
Join me, Melissa Lesniak, creator and host of That Vegan Show, this Friday, February 28th at 11 a.m., where I interview two of the founders of Ratway Sanctuary, Lionel and Laura. They tell us about the rats they care for, and also we get to hear stories about Alice and Paige, some of the special rats that have been in their care. So tune in February 28th at 11 a.m. to hear That Vegan Show.
Andy, whoa, whoa, looks a scream. Andy, moan, my whoa, whoa, whoa. Andy, whoa, whoa, silver stream. Can't tell them apart at all.
My name's Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Seema Famaland. She's the curator of a show called Breathing Room, which is on now at the Lobby Gallery at the Ellen Browning Building through May 24th. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus again, Seema.
Hello.
So Seema, you always curate shows in this lobby of an apartment building on Southeast Division. And you pick a theme, and this show is called Breathing Room. Just give us a sense of what the theme is based on the title, Breathing Room.
Sure. I've noticed that in a lot of artworks, an artist can be a lot of cacophony, can be very overlapping, and there's a lot of energy in their works. Yet sometimes they'll leave a lot of empty space, or they'll use white to give you a little bit of what I always thought was breathing room. And I thought that was a very interesting tactic, especially when you're trying to dissect a painting. And I know that it's so intentional artists to try to kind of square when areas are busy and where areas are less busy. And I just saw that we had a lot of that in our collection. And with a very noisy lifestyle that we have these days, that was even more pertinent.
Noisy in what sense?
Noisy that we have so much happening in our world these days with advertisement, media, lots of imagery coming at us now all the time. I think we're all so glued to screens. And there's just, chatter doesn't stop. We're in a 24/7 world. And with so much chatter, you need to have a pause. You need to breathe. And I guess just sort of my Buddhist little bit that I've sojourned into that area, it's always about pausing. A show like this could also show you how the artwork could have a lot of energy, but it's also not overwhelming. It's sort of like helping you become more tranquil in a sense. It's giving you more space.
Yeah.
With, like I said, a lot of the empty spaces that a lot of artworks have.
So as you walk in the gallery and on the big main wall facing you as you come in, there is a series of strips, probably 15, and they're kind of gold-colored strips that hang maybe 6 feet tall from high up on the wall, and yeah, they're kind of pinned to the wall. As you get closer, you realize they're bronze. So these are hard, wrong metal pinned to the wall. They kind of look to me, I thought they were like strips of bark, you know, it's kind of a nature piece. And then I suddenly realized that there were human fingers at the lower end of these tips. And then I noticed the belly button. And then as I kind of stepped back, I saw the face. Uh-huh. And these strips are all taken from a human body. So it's like you took the skin off someone, really, but all around their body, and then hung strips on the wall. And this piece is called
16 Terminals.
It's by Nataka Hiro. Who is this hero, and what is this piece made of?
Yes. So Hiro is an artist that lives in LA. He's originally from Japan, and he's moved to the United States when he was very young. And he often talks about how he himself has to place himself, and how he feels that he's in two different, sometimes he has to feel like he's in one body and not in two different places. And he also talks a lot about how we can never really know our body because we're in our body. And so he'll use things like cameras or mirrors. The situation with this work, he casts the entire body, which is very uncomfortable, very still for a very long time. And he took off the strips so then he could cast, he could make those cast, and he set them into different strips and install them as you see. And the whole idea here is that he's showing you things that he couldn't see, kind of one piece at a time. And I also liked, again, with the theme of the show, is that there's space in between each strip. And usually when you see a body, it's a full mass and you're kind of confronted with a block. And here, he's giving you space in between each kind of linear part of himself that you can have a pause till you go to the next one. I also love his work because he always uses his body in different ways. Here, you're seeing it very almost one-to-one. It's a cast of his body, and you see the body. He also makes gorgeous paintings and works on paper where he'll often put a hole in the middle of the canvas. He'll position himself in the hole, so it's almost a performance. I feel as if a lot of his work is performative, as is this one.
So he covered himself in like plaster and then let it set and then kind of peeled it off in strips. Is that correct?
Exactly.
The edges are very rough. They have a kind of liquid form, like bills along the edges and down by the toes, say these long, almost like little tails, you know, that are kind of overrun. And then at the very top, similar thing, you can make out the head and the eyes and, you know, piece it all together. And then he took those strips of plaster and then cast them in bronze, which is how we get this beautiful golden metal, which has very high resolution. You know, you can see the structure of his skin, especially on the hand.
Yeah, so you can see all the folds and the wrinkles. And I also thought this was a very interesting piece to be showing in Portland, as Portland is so invested in its natural landscape and trees. And I always, when I talk about Portland, I always mention the foliage and the trees and how beautiful they are. And I felt as if this work had such an interesting relationship to that, to the nature. And I felt when I first saw it, that's immediately what I thought was trees. I thought it was a super interesting juxtaposition here in Portland.
You consider the white spaces between the kind of metal strips as integral to the work?
I do. I think space is integral. I mean, it's usually called negative space, but I also feel that in an artist's mind, they're always playing with negative and positive space. And there's this push-pull that we always hear about. And I think that, like the idea of the show, is that it's the empty space that is part of the work, that the pause between each form. And that's so different than when you just kind of come across one person, one body. Here, you're almost forced to see each piece at a time. each body one at a time.
As you come in the gallery, and then on the left side, there are two walls by the main window, and they're two walls adjacent to each other, and they're covered in what look like hundreds of golf tees. They're little brown wooden varnished pegs, and each one has a white, shiny white ball on top, like a almost like a tiny golf ball. And they're arranged in a kind of swirling pattern, like a flock of birds flying in the sky, or a sort of braided river bed, you know, in a delta. This piece is called Morning Song, and it's by Ranjani Shetar. Tell us a little bit about Ranjani Shetar.
She's from near Bangalore, and now she lives in a little village a little bit outside of Bangalore. So she's not even in a major city, but she did study at some of the major universities. She's now shown all over the world. She recently had a very big installation in London at the Barbican, and it was so well received. They had to extend the date because people just loved it. And it was really her interacting with nature of Ken. And I would say that a lot of her is about how nature interacts with people. And that she worked with a small village also where they still shellac. The women at this village are still shellacking by hand. And it's a tough process. And in today's world with industrialization, it's mostly done by machines. Mm-hmm. But she has found that it can still be done, handcrafted. It's very important to her work. And oftentimes people talk about her work in the relationship of industrialization and society. And I would say it's in because she is always discussing nature in modern life and time, but I've never felt that in her work it's heavy-handed. It's just sort of more in the background. And I asked her, you know, why the song? And she said that every morning she'd go for a walk and she kind of goes in the woods. And a lot of her work has the word morning in it because that's where it feels like she does have like a breath of fresh air almost, that she can really have thoughts sort of come together and she has time to think. And I love a lot of her work. And this is one of my favorites where she really does kind of envelop a huge hug of this work. And it also frames the wall, and it also, it's got a very quietness to it.
Is shellacking just a form of varnish, or is it something else to do with the wood?
It's a form of varnish. That's a good way of thinking about it. I don't know the difference if you would say one word over the other. I think they're very complementary, and I just think it's a way of, as you can see, how every piece is not, you don't see just wood, but it's all kind of painted, but it's not, you can't tell it's painted, which is why I think it's like a varnish, or what we say a shellac, a kind of process, which I guess makes it more fluid.
And are the wooden forms that look like golf tees?
They look like golf tees, yes.
Yeah, they provide the people in the village?
All provided. Ranjani came up with all the wood. No, she does that. And she hand carves. Everything is hand carved. And she finds all of that naturally in her spaces, whether it's that village or her village, but she's always using what she's finding. So it is, again, this whole idea about material. I think a lot of times with her, the material dictates what the idea of the piece will be. Mm-hmm. And so she kind of allows for that, sort of kind of this conversation with the piece. And again, when I thought of this whole idea for the show, her work first came to mind. It's like a gentle breeze, whether it's the wind or it's kind of a water wave, or maybe it's the way birds are flying. And there's just so much lovely space in between. Mm-hmm. Somebody also said it's like a trail of stars. And, you know, then it's like the night sky behind it. I just feel like you can just use your imagination with this one in so many different ways.
And the lighting is pretty dramatic in the shadows of these stalks, these pegs, is very elongated in certain places. And it's quite short in others, kind of like the way the shadows change during the day, but we have this all at once because you've got several white lights above the piece.
When I got this feature about this piece in particular, I asked her, I said, you know, I always feel that the word shadow should be part of the materials because they're so prominent and it's so a part, like you said, like that's how you read it. And she kind of laughed and she said, you know, when she made this work, she only had natural light in her studio. Actually installed it in different places before. We had it installed once on one long wall. So it changes every time you install it, obviously. And she loved that. She loves that every time it's installed, there's a new life. And there's a, what do you want to call it? A template that shows you how to install the work. As you can imagine, it's a big process. And we had, I think, 5 people working for 3 days to make this piece happen. But she kind of loves that idea that light is a part of it and that changes how you read it and how it looks and how you see it, basically.
Yeah. My name's Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Seema Famaland. She's the curator of Breathing Room, a show on now at the Lobby Gallery at the Ellen Browning Building through May 24th. As you come in the door and turn right, the first piece is an untitled piece by Kwon Young Woo, and it's a super minimalist piece. It's a white square of canvas, and it's been scored from the bottom upwards, and the scores get slightly more deep and kind of ragged as it gets at the top, and then it ends before the canvas ends in a sort of splitting. And this is just called Untitled. Why did you pick this?
Well, I have a thing for white. I think you can see so much when it's just white, when there's no extra color, like little things really show up. And Kwon Young Woo is one of the pioneers of the Korean Dasangwa movement, which is a movement that happened in post-war Korea. And he's one of, I would say, a handful of artists that have become very famous exploring abstraction after this time. And I just can't help reading this after war, thinking about gouging the painting canvas. I mean, it's just so literal almost, but it's so physical. Kwon Young Woo first was exploring abstract expressionism, and he started using very unconventional materials. And he started using paper as one of the backgrounds. And he realized just over time that he actually could say much more with just focusing on paper and just manipulating the paper itself. And so this is a very almost typical work of his, where it's only paper and him manipulating it with these kind of incisions that, you know, go from like very deep to very shallow, or very shallow to very deep, depending on how you want to read it. And I just always felt that this subtle mark making just had so much intensity. I loved that dichotomy, that it's very subtle, yet it feels very intense. I can't help but think there's just so many pauses within this work. I mean, you kind of go up one line, leave a pause, and then you go down another line. And I think that was his intention, is that you have to follow a line and then you have to stop and pause and break or breathe. When I thought of the show also, he was definitely somebody that I was thinking about.
When did this movement peak?
So it was post-World War II. The Korean population are also very big art collectors, and art is a very big part of their culture, like it is for most cultures. And they just, there was so many people, it sort of became a movement because there was a nice kind of group of artists that were working in very similar ways. And there was a nice easy way to put them all together, like we do in the US with abstract expressionism coming after our post-war. And when you think about Jackson Pollock and Rothko and Klein, they were able to do that also with the Korean group of artists. So you have a few other artists working, like I said, in this kind of vein in very different ways, but also you can see a nice cross-section of how they all relate. And they're all thinking in a sense of the same thing. So it's almost a zeitgeist of that moment. I would say in the art community, there's been a lot of looking back and finding artists that we haven't been thinking about recently. And I would say this Korean post-war movement in the last, maybe the last 10 years or so, it's gotten a lot more attention. Both galleries and museums have done major exhibitions, and the artists, especially those that are still living, are seeing a lot more attention paid to their work.
Adjacent to that piece is a large canvas, probably like 6 by 8 feet, and it's called White Linen, and it's by Jeff Elrod. It's from 2005, so it's kind of old, 20 years old. It's kind of white on brown. That's the main color, sort of abstract shapes, big, thick lines in the middle, and then sort of almost scribble, like done by a computer mouse, sort of jagged towards the edges. How is this even made? Because I can't tell which is the top surface. I think the white is on top of the brown.
Correct. So Jeff Elrod is known for these type of abstract paintings, and it's based on his digital drawings. He is using a mouse to make a drawing, and then he's using that drawing and he's translating it into a painting. So translating it onto canvas. And Elrod was one of the first artists that I knew that was putting specifically computer ideas into painting. And when I first heard about it, I was so upset. I thought painting is sacred, and in painting, it's really about the hand. And having spoken with Jeff many years ago and through the years, he really explained to me, I mean, he is a connoisseur of painting and painters, and he can tell you anything. He's sort of got one of these encyclopedic memories about art and artwork that he's looked at throughout the years. And he really understands the gestures of abstraction. And so it's this very specific to when he's using the computer, because it's a lot, well, how do we get images? And in today's world, when this has started to happen over 20 years ago further, we were starting to make images on the computer. Then it became, well, how do I do that with a painting, or how do I still make paintings when the image is computer?
How does he get the white onto the brown canvas? Is it screen print?
No, but it's projections, and then he's hand painting. It's very hand. It's really going from technology to hand. And that's very important for him. And the brown that you're seeing is the actual canvas. It's just him using the to kind of make the image. And then again, it's this kind of conversation between this, what is the blank space and what is the positive space. I think that's really part of it. And a lot of his work I've seen uses very hot colors, and it's painted all over and there's no blank space. And so I always thought this was having a lot of pauses that allowing space to kind of give you a calm, because, you know, it's a very chaotic imagery that created.
So the thick white lines have an area of brown around them, and then there's a sort of general background of white. It's as though each line has sort of cleared a space around itself. The edges are so straight, it's like he probably painted with the masking tape and peeled it off, get these sharp lines.
Probably, I don't know exactly. Yeah, but he's definitely trying to create like a one-to-one of the drawing image to the canvas. So I wouldn't be surprised. Like whatever it takes to get that exact image would have. And you know, you could see whatever you want to. Like in any artwork, you can create what you want. But I will say that we've always talked about this as it looks like a butterfly.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I was thinking maybe a spider.
No idea if that is any. Yeah, it just feels like it has that kind of momentum. And I guess that's also why it felt sort of right in this show. It sort of had like some sort of connection nature, whether it was meant to be or not.
Sima, right by the concierge desk in this apartment building lobby gallery,
yes,
is piece. It's in a big vitrine, and it's sort of a squiggly ceramic sphere with a slight lip at the top. It's Moon Jar Number 2 by Kwango Lee. What I know about moon jars is it's a thing Koreans do in ceramics. They try and make a sort of perfect spherical bowl. It's very hard, right? Because you have to make two hemispheres.
Very traditional.
Yeah, try and attach them together. But this is a more like a sort of punk rock version of that. It's thick, coiled, yellow, sort of banana yellow ceramic.
Yeah.
It's like if you made the whole thing out of giant toothpaste and somehow knitted it, you create this sphere which has a little base and a little neck. And of course, you know, it's a bowl, but it's completely useless, right? Because it's full of holes. What do we know about Kwang-ho Lee?
Yes, everything's going to fall through. So Kwang-ho Lee is, yes, he is Korean. And this is his interpretation of what we would call the traditional Chinese jar. And in this case, he uses 3D printing. So like you said, it's almost like the rock and roll version. It's a very anti what you would expect from the traditional way of making a moon jar. He's about materials, but in this case, it's sort of, again, this conflation of modern materials with something very traditional. Sort of the idea of traditional with how do you redo it, or how do you upgrade it, or kind of bring it more into today's world. And Kwang-ho Lee is a very well-known young artist in Korea, very much more a part of the design world. And again, I love that idea too of what world, does it matter where your ideas are coming from or where they're being placed? And I think this emergence of different ideas from the design world, from the art world, from nature, from computers, sort of everything sort of collapses together in different ways, which is something that I was trying to do for this show, all different generations, all different places. But I will say, because of his involvement in the design world specifically, he's more well known for making objects, sort of like more furniture, I would say, is a big deal for him. And this was a project that he did to kind of do a take on the moon jar.
Yeah, now I look closer, I can see it's that rough kind of printed plastic, you know, that sort of 3D printing polymer, but it's been glossed, you know, it's got a super shiny kind of resin clear coat, makes it more look like ceramic.
Yes, it does. And I think that's part of it too. It also looks like it's very plushy, like you could squeeze it, but you can. It's hard. So again, and a bowl, it should be a jar, it should be hard. But like you said, this has holes in it. So it's not really functional. And again, that I think is great too. Lots of empty spaces, which I think kind of adds to the idea of it's giving you space to breathe.
I do like the idea that you go into a gallery for some respite from, you know, modern communications, because it does make you think about what is it in art that would kind of soothe us these days. And you're kind of saying a lot of it is the spaces between things in the art, which probably make us think about, you know, absence and spaces in the rest of our life that could be kind of soothing.
Yeah. And if you think about it, I feel that especially in today's world, space is such a commodity because we have people kind of living almost on top of each other in cities. And it usually costs more to be out in some sort of idyllic nature, like by the water and the countryside. It's usually big sprawling houses with, you know, miles in between them to the next one. And I think also with art, you think of like, oh, you're buying more stuff. It's just more noise that you're putting into your life. Yet I feel that oftentimes, as you were just saying, art can also bring kind of tranquility and kind of show you life in a different way.
My name is Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week was curator Seema Famalant. She was talking about Breathing Room, a show on now at the Lobby Gallery at the Ellen Browning Building on Southeast Division, which is on through May 24th. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus again, Seema, this time by Zoom. You're in Austin. I'm walking around holding my laptop. This is a first.
Thanks again, Joseph. I loved it. Thank you.
Andy, whoa, whoa, looks a scream. Andy, on my whoa, 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 whoa. Andy, whoa, whoa, silver stream. Can't tell them apart at all.
sintonizando KBOO Portland, tu radio comunitaria, a través del 90.7 FM KBOO Portland y en línea a través de KBOO.fm.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo.